Good morning, this is Lindy Hughes, and I'm representing the Tualatin Historical Society for a Veterans History Project. It's April 19th, 2007, and I'm here with Dan Bernath, and Mr. Bernath will be sharing some of his military experiences and memories with us today. So Dan, can I have you state your full name and branch of service?
Daniel Ellen Bernath, and my branch of service was U.S. Navy, and it was from December 15th, 1966 to May something, 1970.
Okay. Dan, what were you doing before you joined the service, and what got you involved in the war effort?
Well, let's see. I joined the Navy at 15, and I must have been 16. I had a Michigan driver's learner's permit, and it was paper. So I took an eraser and changed my date of birth and made myself 18 instead of 16. And I joined the Navy, and all the papers were signed, and they were coming by. The chief petty officer recruiter was coming by the house at the last minute to have some further papers signed, and I wasn't there. And they said, how can Danny be joining the Navy when he's 16? So that didn't work. So then as soon as I turned 17, I joined again. And that time they said, fine, now you're 17. So I was just a high school student. I think before that I had dropped out of high school, and I went to live with my brother on an Air Force base, Kinchlow Air Force Base in Upper Michigan, and I was a disc jockey. They had a base radio station, so I was a disc jockey. And he was interested in photography, and he got me interested in photography, and then I started to do that. Maybe some darkroom work and some pictures. But I want to be in the Navy rather than the other branches of service, because the Navy took you everywhere. So I knew that we were at war, but the Navy's all over the world, so I didn't know where they're going to send me. And in fact, Vietnam was only part of my service, 3 years, 5 months. So let's see. So having lived with him on the Air Force base for 3 months, I was sure that I didn't want to join the Air Force because it seemed real boring. So I went in the Navy. Then they sent me to boot camp. They put us on a train from the Great Lakes, Illinois, where the Navy boot camp is. And they put us on a train from Detroit to Chicago, and the Chicago to suburban Illinois, Chicago. So on the train, we're riding like civilians, and they said, okay, it's time for dinner. And I thought, okay, now they're going to hand me a sandwich. But we went to the dining car, and there's this beautiful little steak and tiny little potatoes and all that, and, you know, like ice water in a nice glass. I'm going, boy, this Navy is really nice. I've never been treated this well. But of course, that was just the train. So anyway, so boot camp, and that was, even though I'm a high school dropout, I went in the Navy. They allowed us to, we were taught by an ensign if you wanted to, and we got our high school diplomas. And then after that, I went to college, and after that, I went to law school. So I'm one of the few dropouts that became a lawyer. But I say this, that Navy boot camp and law school were the two hardest things I've done in my life, you know. So that's, people are surprised to hear that, but Navy boot camp was very rough, more psychological than physical. Maybe because I was so young, but the whole idea is that they never allow you to sleep more than 4 hours a day. I think that, and then there's so much coming at you, so much information coming at you, and It was so cold, and you know, so that was very hard. But it proved to me at a very young age that I could do anything if I just applied myself. So I kept telling myself that, you know, my dad made it through boot camp, and I can make it through boot camp. You know, no matter how tough it got, you know, you're up at 2 a.m, you know, peeling potatoes or whatever the thing was. You know, just no. I'm always thinking, my dad made it through boot camp, and so can I. So I get out of boot camp, and I go, Jesus, that tough, Dad. But I kept saying to myself, Dad made it through boot camp, because he was in World War II in the Army, and I can make it through boot camp. And he looks at me and says, I never went to boot camp. He says it was World War II, you know, and the Michigan National Guard drafted me, and I went right into combat. And I go, oh, okay. Well, I'm glad you told me after instead of before, because that was how I got through it. You know, Dad can do it. So then they sent me to the Kearsarge, which is an aircraft carrier, an Essex class carrier, which was it wasn't built in time for World War II, but it was one of the swift carriers, the fast carriers that the Navy attributes to winning the war, because it they do 32 knots. The Japanese had nothing; they could. It was just an overwhelming force. So that was one of them, and. We spent a tour 6 months off the coast of North and South Vietnam, and then there was a then they said, well, the Kearsarge needs to be renovated, so we're going to go into the yards when we get back to California. And I knew what that was like. That's 140 decibels. You're living inside a ship that's being renovated. So I said, well, chief, can I ship over and go on the next carrier that's coming out to replace us? And they thought that was great. So three or four of us did that. We went to the Yorktown, and I'm glad I did, because I remember it was just at that point that we got word that the communists, North Koreans, had captured the USS Pueblo. So there was speculation as to what we were going to do. Were we going to attack them? Were we going to try to do a rescue mission? And the people on the Kearsarge were going, well, we're going home. Too bad this doesn't affect us. And by then, my orders had come through that I was going to transfer to the Yorktown. They go, what, you're going to, you know, they're making jokes. Like, you're going to have to learn how to pronounce Punnengang and, you know, all that stuff. You know, see you later, Dan. Ha ha. You know, you're going to Korea. And I'm like, well, shit. What have I done? So the Kearsarge comes in to Japan for a few hours to just reload and get more supplies, and I get off and I take my stuff off, and my two or three buddies who are also transferring, and the Kearsarge goes, and then the Yorktown comes right there, and then suddenly I'm on the Yorktown, and so word comes down that guess what, the Kearsarge and the Yorktown are both going to Korea. So they thought, so I thought, well, that's a joke on them too. So anyway, we went to Korea, and we went right from Japan straight into Korea, and we were the first ship, and our task force was the first ship and task force to go to Korea. We just to rattle sabers and to do a show of force. So the orders were very strange, in that they said, don't use your radar, and just go at flank speed. So that's what Captain Bennett did. They made him the admiral. There was no admiral at the time on the ship, so they made him the temporary admiral. He just died recently. So we just roared into off the coast of North Korea to show them that you can't do that. But of course they did. So there was supposed to be a list going around about who wanted to train with the Marines. The Marines were going to be the nucleus, and we're going to go in. I mean, it's just silly. That we were going to have a group that was going to somehow rescue these sailors from the USS Pueblo. But the orders were, shoot anything that comes near you. And then the orders were downgraded. You know, identify, don't shoot unless they're hostile, and then don't shoot unless they shoot at you first. So it just kept getting, it was Lyndon Johnson was president then. So it just kept getting downgraded. So The Russians, for their part, seeing as they thought that was their sphere of influence, reacted to us in the way that they had a spy ship follow us wherever we went, and then the spy ship would try to cut into us, like we would be cruising along doing flight operations or whatever, and the Russian ship would cross our bow, and the orders from the captain were, don't divert. If we're going to hit them, we're going to hit them. And so that went on, for 30 days. And that was one way the Russians reacted to us. The other way was, the other thing was that our radar showed, we have a screen of destroyers around us, and at one point in the night, the Russian had gotten inside of our screen. So you have, you know, you have the carrier, and then you have the destroyers on each side of you and one behind you. The Russian had gotten in between us, which we considered to be an act of war. Do we blow him up now, or do we wait till dawn? What do we do? And by dawn, he had moved out. So it's pretty tense. We didn't know what was going to happen. The other thing about the Russians is that they have this thing called bear bombers, and they're propeller-driven and very loud, and they would fly over us very low altitude to test us to see how fast we could react. Mm. So we would go to general quarters, and jets from the Enterprise would go up and meet them. And it was just this is what the Cold War was all about, where we'd play chicken with the Russians, and they'd play chicken with us all the time. So we would be up there with our A4s in the North Atlantic this also occurred. So the Yorktown jets in the North Atlantic, we would be up there, and it looked like feet behind them. So you're standing there on the flight deck, and you're watching two or three Russian bear bombers. I mean, just consider this gigantic airplane, propeller-driven, and then behind it would be this tiny, you know, in comparison, A4 United States Navy plane. And I'm sure he was all ready to go. He was locked and loaded, and you twitch, then the Navy plane is going to blow the Russian out of the sky. And so that was how we played chicken with the Russians during the Cold War. So I always considered the Vietnam War just to be a major battle in the Cold War. So what did you ask me? So then, then we went to Vietnam. And then there was search and rescue. Our main mission was anti-submarines. There were no Russian submarines in the Gulf of Tonkin. So we were the base for search and rescue. A plane would be shot down. If the search and rescue squadron was aboard, then they'd leave from our ship. We'd rescue people. That was our main job, and constant squadron activity. So we left Vietnam, and then we got, I don't know where I got the word, but I got word that we were going to, I remember walking in the photo lab, and one of my buddies said, "Hey Dan, did you hear? We're going to pick up the astronauts." And I said, "You know, we're too busy for that. You know, I really, can't they use a cruiser or something, you know? Because we're like an aircraft carrier, and we got all these squadrons, and, you know, we got work to do. We're looking for Russian submarines, you know?" So that was my attitude. It's kind of funny now, you know, here's this amazingly prestigious thing for the whole country, like, my God, we're sending the first men to the moon. And I'm like, well, yeah, we got real work to do. So I was, and the president and the chairman of naval operations never, you know, asked for my opinion, so it just went forward. So what did we do next?
Well, getting back to your search and recovery, you were recovering ship or planes that went down,
and the pilots would be
the ocean.
They would sometimes. And you just, mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes they would crash into the ocean. They'd punch out over the ocean, the Gulf of Tonkin, or they'd punch out over North Vietnam, and the Gilas would go in and capture them. The Kearsarge was famous for going right into, I think it's Hanoi Harbor, just roaring right into the heart of North Vietnam and rescuing a Navy pilot. So that's what the Kearsarge is famous for. But the squadron would leave. There was always a search and rescue squadron was always there. So, I mean, the ships needed relief. They had to go into port. Mm-hmm. So the squadron would switch from carrier to carrier.
So did your assignments on the ship change during the time you were on the Yorktown?
Well, when I was on the Kearsarge as a photographer, and I'd taken the test and qualified as a photographer's mate, petty officer, third class, I'd taken the test, and they said, didn't say anything. I thought I had gotten it. I got the recommendation and all that sort of thing, and then I transferred. I went to the Yorktown and said, well, here I am. I'm your new photographer's mate. Where's the photo lab? They said, oh, no, we need bosun's mates. Is that what you're asking about? So I said, no, I'm a photographer. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, we got all we need of those. So what had happened is, before I got aboard, one of my bosun's mate buddies was on the helm, so he knew what happened. The helm control just stopped during an underway replenishment. And underway replenishment, also known as an on-rep, is when the oiler will come up beside us, and then we send lines over, and they send over a huge hose, and they fill us up with black oil and JP5, the jet plane fuel. And what happened is that for some reason the helm control was lost when my buddy was on the helm, and he said it just made this big hum noise, and he reported to the captain or the officer of the deck, I've lost helm control, and the captain jumped up like he was shot and looked at him like it was his fault, you know. He's like so what happened is the Yorktown could not be steered for those few seconds until they went to auxiliary control, so it started to drift away from the oiler, pulled the oil hose out, spraying black oil along the side of the Yorktown. So, I show up and they're going, well, we need somebody to, the bosun's mates are going to have to clean that up. So that's my first job is, where I'm out there with JP5 fuel with my new friends, and we're like putting sponges into the jet plane fuel, and we're washing the side of the ship because it's covered in jet plane fuel. So I said, I took the test, I'm a photographer, I'm a petty officer third class. And he said, well, not until we get official word that you are, so, get back to work. So, I spent 3 months as a bosun's mate, and it was probably one of the most 3 months of my life, and I'm like kicking and screaming because I was a real sailor for 3 months, I wasn't like one of these, perfumed princes. I was like a real sailor, I'm out there hanging off the side of the ship on, on nets, and part of the job, two or three watches we were responsible for in 2nd Division. We had bridge watch, and then we also had we call it the 6-inch gun, but other people call it the 5-inch 38s or something. So we manned the guns, and then we also did the bridge watch. And manning the gun was kind of boring, except that we could see North Vietnam being shelled. At night you just look out and see, look like lightning. We were that close. It was just flash, flash, flash. Just so that was the only interesting part of that. But we'd sit on the gun and be ready to power her up and load her while fire control took over. So that was part of our. So you'd work all day long, and then you'd have these watches, which was 4 hours. You'd either do the deck, or you'd do the helm, or you would do the gun. So some of my buddies hated to be on the bridge because it was very tense. You had to wear a clean shirt, and you had to wear your white Navy hat, and there were all these high-ranking officers running back and forth, and they're very tense. And I thought that was a blast. So I would trade with these other guys. They'd say, oh my God, I got the got the goddamn bridge, and I go, I'll trade you. I got a gun watch. You sit on my gun watch, and I'll do your bridge watch. So I got to the point where I got to do all these. And the fun part was that you actually, you know, who steers this ship? The deck crew does. You know, who's actually got their hands on the helm? So I got 8 hours on the helm, and with 10 hours you get to be, you get a certificate saying that you're an official helmsman. And with that comes the trust of the captain or whoever that you can be the helmsman during flight operations. So I'd be on the helm before the 10 hours, and we'd start to recover planes or launch planes, and I had to be relieved by somebody who had the certificate. And I go, well, this, okay, fine. I had to step aside, and then we'd recover the planes, and then I'd take over again. But I got 8 hours. And looking back 40 years, I'm thinking the biggest regret I have is that after I was promoted back to the photo lab, I didn't just go up there and say, can I just take the helm for 2 hours, and you can put it in the logbook that I'm on the helm, and then I get 10 hours, and I'd be like one of the only photographer mate certified, qualified helmsmen. But, that's the biggest vessel I've ever driven, you know, like a 900-foot aircraft carrier. And you think, well, you just point it and it goes, but it's constantly, there's the currents are hitting the side and the rudder and all that. So you're constantly keeping it on course. I mean, it's like driving a car. You're constantly turning the wheel. Mm-hmm. But the real fun part was, you know, you headed to, there is pride amongst the helmsmen. Well, they always called me the Airedale because they all knew my story. See, they go like, you don't belong here, and they call me the Airedale because, you know, I'm an aviation person. I'm actually an airman, and they're all seamen, you know. So I'm on the helm, and they taught me how to do that. And the real fun part is when the officer of the deck would give you an order to make a severe turn, then you wouldn't want to just turn. You would spin this big brass wheel, you know, like you're standing up and it's like this big. Mm-hmm. You would spin this big brass wheel as far as you could go, and you'd watch the nose of the ship turning toward the new heading. And then when you got maybe 5 degrees from that new heading, you would spin the wheel in the opposite direction so that the rate of turn would decrease. And it would decrease to the point where if you did this correctly, the ship would stop directly on the new heading that the officer had ordered. And there'd be no sloppiness where you went over 1 degree or you were under 1 degree. You would just stop the ship directly on that new heading. Now, if you did this correctly, then all your friends who are standing there in the dark with you, they go, oh, cool, man, far out, you know. And if you did it wrong, then they would harass you for days afterwards. So that was the real fun thing, is that you do something like that. You know, you just look at this, well, it looks easy, you just kind of do that, and it's like, well, no, there's a lot more to it, like anything else, you know, a lot more to it. So,
Well, can you tell me about your role as a photographer, about the assignments you got, and if you were the photographer for the Apollo 8 recovery?
There was when my promotion came through, you know, then I went down to the personnel office because the list came in and said, you know, Dan Bernath promoted to Petty Officer Third Class Photographer's Mate. So I went down to the personnel office, and I said to the warrant officer, see? And he goes, yeah, like I care, you know. He goes, well, you know, I want to assign you to the photo lab, but, I was seeing the guys up there, they're still, like, scraping paint, and so I want to keep you in the deck division. And I was like, outraged. I said, I'm a petty officer, third class photographer's mate now. So he just sat back at his desk and roared in laughter and goes, I was just kidding. Congratulations, you know, go ahead, you know, go to the photo lab. And I think by then I was already promoted, but the word got to us later. So I'm like, so I went to the photo lab. And then, then we get to that story where, we're off the coast of Vietnam for 6 months, and then I don't know what happened. We went to Hawaii or something. I don't know how we got word, but you know, I got word that we're going to pick up this stupid capsule and waste our time when we've got other important things to do. So the next step after that was they brought aboard a boilerplate, they called it, which looked like a capsule, and maybe it was the same weight and all that, and they would drop it into the ocean, and we would go out and we'd get it, and we'd practice. So over and over again, we practiced getting that capsule and bringing it aboard, and then the press came aboard, and ABC Television must have won the, or it was their turn, I don't know what, but ABC came aboard and they brought gigantic trucks full of equipment, and we just picked it up and put it onto our hangar deck and tied it down, and then we went out 1,000 miles off Hawaii and basically waited because they had already been launched. A friend of mine said it was the weirdest thing because he was in boot camp in Florida, and he watched the Apollo take off, and he left Florida. He went to the Yorktown, and just as we were going out to pick the capsule up. So I mean, it was the most bizarre thing. He saw it actually being launched and recovered. I mean, I don't know how many people actually saw that, but he just happened to be in boot camp, and they said, okay, if you look out to the east or wherever it was, you can see Cape Canaveral, and that white line going up is Apollo 8, the first people to go to the moon. So he had a unique perspective. My perspective was that the thing I liked about being a photographer is that I was everywhere, and everyone just kind of accepted that I was there. So I was just, you know, and I... When you're on a ship in the middle of the ocean, in the middle, you know, there's no TV to watch, there's nothing to do, so you just kind of like go visit your buddies. So you just go from division to division and say hi to people and all that sort of thing. So people are just kind of used to seeing me around. So that's what I would do. So I knew all the navigators. I like to visit the navigators because they never told us where we were. So I would just kind of like, I wonder where we are. I wonder what we're doing. So I'd go see the navigators, say, where are we? And they go, we're right here, Dan, we're right here. And then they'd always get, we never really know where we're going next. So we're going to go to Hong Kong, we're going to go to the Philippines, we're going to go to Japan, we're going to Australia. You know, we would never know. So they had the best word because they hung out and they would get word, you know, like set a course for, or it's probable you'll go to the Philippines next. So I'd ask them, where are we going? You know, so that was fun. So I remember... before the capsule came to us, the astronauts came to us, then we were just killing time. So we put on a smoker, where we put on like a talent show, and you know, I don't know, they must have had tryouts because these guys were reasonable. I mean, they weren't just awful, they were all, you know, like 4 or 5 or 10 people, and they were actually, you know, pretty decent, and they play the guitar, and they have, or they tell jokes or whatever. So ABC was there, and they were bored because they had nothing to do. So, so what they did was film this thing. So here we are, these amateur musicians and such, and they're bored. So they filmed it, and then they put together this package. As if it, they said, "Well, we'll do it, and it'll look like an Elvis extravaganza," you know. So they did that, and we had this closed-circuit TV system for watching a movie, one movie a night, and they made a videotape of this because they're bored, you know, and it was, like, phenomenal. You know, buddies, you know, people I knew playing the guitar, and it'd be like they'd be singing some Beatles song or something like that, and be, you know, a close-up of them, you know, and then they superimposed the close-up of their hands while they're, like, panning and then zooming out. It's, like, amazing. So then we had... The captain thought that we should have some recreation time, so he said, we're going to allow you to swim. So here we are in the middle of the ocean, and he stops the ship. And I remember it was very strange because the sensation is always you're moving forward, and the ship is always always vibrating. And we'd stopped dead in the Pacific, and you know, like hundreds of guys are like climbing off the ship in the nets and jumping in there. The Marines are standing up on the flight deck with their rifles in case there's sharks. And both times the captain cut it short because somebody said there was a shark, and then suddenly they all got out of the water. And then the other time, I forget, the weather was too bad. So that's what we're doing, waiting for them. And then it was... the thing about being in the Navy is that you never know what day it is, and you never know... The only way we knew that it was Christmas is because you go down to the mess decks and the cooks would put up, you know, decorations or something. You'd go, oh, must be Christmas today. And you'd look at the calendar, you know, oh, okay, December, yeah, 25th, okay, it's Christmas, you know, okay, fine. But your day is not changed at all. I mean, it's like you work a full day and then you have a watch of some type, you know, you have additional duties. So we had, you know, maybe we had ham too. You know, why are we having ham today? Otherwise, it's just another day. So then I remember that we're in our, it was after working hours, and I was in my compartment, berthing compartment, and then the captain came on. He said, men of the Yorktown, we've just gotten word that the astronauts have spoken to us, or have just made radio contact again. They were on the other side of the moon, and we didn't know if they're going to keep going or if they made it, but they've just talked to us or something. So it was a big cheer. I could hear, you know, throughout the ship, people cheering, you know, because that meant that they were alive. So then what did we do? So I don't remember if it was the next day or how long it took them to go from the moon to the Earth. I don't remember that. Mm-hmm. But the day of them coming back, we knew what day that was going to be. And I think I got up at 4 a.m. and got into my dress white uniform because that was the orders, because we're going to be on television today around the world. So I remember getting up and I was really excited. You know, instead of getting up at 4 a.m. and going, oh, shit, it's 4 a.m. You know, it's 0400. I just got up and I was like, okay, what do I do today? And my chief said, okay, what you're going to do is you're going to be... I mean, he had this whole list. I mean, we're going to record history for, you know, for the Navy, because there's Associated Press is there, ABC is there, and it's mostly pooled. It wasn't like hundreds of photographers. It was more like pools. You know, like there was Reuters, maybe Associated Press, UPI, but it wasn't thousands of photographers. So we were recording it for the Navy, and then we'd give the pictures out to the press in case we got something they didn't get. So my job was to get pictures of the capsule as it was picked up out of the water and brought aboard. So other people had other jobs, and I was only a third class petty officer. So the first class petty officer, Richard Starkey, assigned himself the coolest job, which was to actually be on the flight deck as the helicopter came in. And then, so I had nothing to do at the moment. So I went up to where the signalmen were, and I think that was around the 06 or 05 level, I forget which, the guys who do the semaphores and have the flags. So I went up there, and I said, I can't, where is it? Where's the capsule? And they said, what kind of Navy is this that we have a blind photographer? You know, Jesus, it's right there. And I'm like, oh yeah, right. And it's dark, it's 4:30, you know. There it is, it's right there, you know, you dumbass. So I go, okay, fine. You know, some sailors talk to each other. And nobody saw it come down. You know, we're all waiting for it to come down. Where is it? Where is it? You know, we're thinking that it's only reasonable that we should look out and see it coming down. And what happened was that NASA, you know, they're new to this game. They had calculated that it would come down, and it was almost going to hit the Yorktown. Memos were written by NASA later about how how dangerous was this? It almost hit the Yorktown. I mean, it was, if we had looked straight up, we probably could have seen it coming at us. So it could have been the most, it could have been the biggest tragedy ever in the space history, that they make it all the way to the moon and back and then hit the aircraft carrier. So they said, maybe we should be off by a few miles, and they go out and get it rather than, so it was coming right at us. So I'm on the 06 level and with the signalman, because my job isn't kicking in yet. But it gave me one of the best vantage points of seeing them come aboard. So the way it operated was that HS4, Helicopter Squadron 4, somehow had fallen into being the Navy helicopter squadron when it comes to spacemen. You know, maybe they did it once or twice, but from then on, it had to be HS4. We got to get HS4. So HS4, and then they have one helicopter. Somehow, old 66, you know, looks like a flying boxcar, you know, these HS-3A Sikorsky helicopters. Mm-hmm. But old 66, big 6-6 on the side, that had to be the airship that would get the astronauts, right? So it's like this Navy tradition that somehow developed. So old 66 went out there and got them. The UDT sailors were already in the water. They're called SEALs now, but they call them UDT then, Underwater Demolition Team. So they brought them aboard, and the old 66 came on and landed, and then the door opens, and the three of them come out, and I thought, you know, like, were they practicing this? Because I think it was Anders, astronaut Anders, Air Force colonel, I think, he came down one or two steps, and then, I can't remember exactly, but Borman and Lovell, they kind of stood up there, and it was like you know, like the Iwo Jima picture, you know, like, how could it be so posed? But it was like, one was like down one step, and one's over here like this, and one's like that, and it was like this perfect picture of them coming out, and everybody just roaring with applause, and they came down, our captain met him, and I think that it's a Navy tradition, you just don't come aboard a ship, you ask permission. So I think that Captain Lovell saluted Captain Fifield and said, request permission to come aboard, and permission was granted. And then they walked from there over to elevator number 3, and then they went down, and then they went to sick bay, and then the president called, and they talked to President Johnson on the telephone over some sort of radio connection, and they're, you know, I thought that was kind of bizarre, kind of weird, because here we are. They had left their, you know, they really looked kind of scummy, and they, you know, because they hadn't shaved or bathed. And I thought, this is kind of strange, you know. Yeah, it's funny, you're right in the middle of history, you don't really think that, you're thinking something else. And I'm thinking, this is kind of odd. So here they are, sitting on my Yorktown, my home, in my sick bay, looking kind of scummy, wearing pajamas, talking to the President of the United States, my Commander-in-Chief. I mean, in the service, you know, as a civilian, look at the President as being somebody you elect or you don't elect. But as a sailor or a Marine or a soldier, you look at the President as being your boss. He's actually the highest officer. You know, you have your chief and then your lieutenant, your captain, you know, Chief of Naval Operations, you know, Secretary of Defense, and the President. He's just one of them. So I'm thinking, well, this is really odd. So what do we do next? The thing about, so they got new clothes, and the thing I noticed about them is that they were just three of the nicest guys, you know. I remember they went up to a buddy of mine, a Marine, who was assigned to follow them and guard them. I don't know from what, but the Marine, but Captain Lovell came up to him and said, sorry that you missed your Christmas. And the Marine said, well, what a great privilege it is to be here. And then that goes back to what I was telling you about Christmas. You know, Christmas is just another day. If you didn't tell me it was Christmas, you could tell me a week later and say, you know, we had Christmas last week. And I would say, oh, really? You know, fine. You know, did I get a candy cane or something? You know? So, but they would, they constantly just walked around and just went up to us and shook our hands and asked us about where we were from. And, you know, so they're just, you know, a great bunch of guys. And the thing about being a photographer is that I've been in every, we have a thing called a cruise book, which means we put together a book of, basically we're out to sea for 6 to 8 months, and we put together a bunch of pictures, and individual pictures of each of us, and pictures of our divisions at work. So I like doing that because I was sent to every division on the ship, and I get to see everybody. And I got to meet everybody, and so I got to know the Marines. We had a Marine detachment. So what they had done was they took the capsule. When it came back to Earth, then they had a heat shield on the bottom of it. So as it encountered the atmosphere, then it would burn off, and thus the astronauts would survive the intense heat. But what was left behind were fragments of the heat shield that was still connected to the capsule. It was just burnt off. So I went to, so they put ropes up around, a perimeter around the capsule. We tied it down just like it was another aircraft. You know, this aircraft that had gone to the moon and back. It was just another aircraft to us. We tied it down as we usually do. And then the captain put a Marine to guard it 24 hours a day. Which didn't mean anything because the Marine wasn't a Marine to me. A Marine was a buddy of mine. So I went up to him and I said, you know, it'd really be nice, Mike, I forgot his name, if you would go up there and just rip off a part of that heat shield and give it to me. He goes, yeah, why not? So he just went up there and he ripped off a part of the heat shield and gave it to me. It was like a golden foil. And then there's also a little bit of a screw that was attached to it. And I go, well, that's kind of cool. So I kept that for, years and years and years in a box. And then I found out later that the Yorktown became a museum. It's in Charleston, South Carolina Harbor. So I said, would you like to have this? And they said, yeah. So based, that's like one of the that's like one of the centerpieces of their whole exhibit. They took part of the hangar deck, and I had a picture that was set in a box where the UDT guys, they had the UDT guys in the foreground in their raft, and then you have the capsule floating, and then you have the Yorktown coming towards you in the background. So I had a 11x14 black and white picture of that, and I gave that to the Yorktown Museum, and I gave that gold piece of the heat shield to the Yorktown Museum. And then I see what they have done with that little picture I gave them. They made that picture as big as the side of a building, and they took that foil and they put it into a case and says property of Dan Bernath, on loan from, and all those pictures I gave them that I took and my shipmates took, they just made this huge display. And then a trade school in the area made a exact duplicate of the Apollo 8 capsule. So, and I'm thinking, well, gee, if you guys had only asked, I would have given it to you a lot sooner. I didn't know that it was history sitting in my closet here. So, you can have it, And now I'm told that 600,000 people a year visit that and look at those pictures. And a friend of mine says, I visited the Yorktown. I saw your name there on the exhibit. So. It's like I'm saying, when you're 17 or 18 or 19, you don't know that all this stuff is happening. It's interesting that when I finally got back to Detroit, my hometown, then it was like, I just if I had mentioned, and I didn't mention, that I'd been on the Apollo 8 recovery, no one would have cared because it was old news, you know. So that's kind of amusing. It's like, well, you're so, you know, what else is new? You know, what have you done lately? So,
go ahead.
So we had the captain realized, or he may have been under orders to get them back as soon as possible. I think the president wanted to see them right away. Mm-hmm. So he ordered that all of our boilers be fired up, which meant we could do flank speed back to Hawaii. So we're doing just, they called him 8-boiler Fifield is what the press called him, because we were just hauling ass getting to within range of Hawaii. And I think they had taken urine samples from the astronauts and other samples, medical samples, and of course they couldn't wait to get this. What they had to do, it was like a James Bond movie. They took they put the samples into like a box of some type, and then they hoisted it in the weather balloon high above the Yorktown, and then this huge plane came by with a looked like a cow catcher on it, and it snatched the thing and then flew off to Hawaii while it reeled this box in. I mean, they just, everything was just, you know, beyond description. Everything was over the top. So NASA came aboard and they had their own photographer, and you know, our equipment, I was used to using speed graphics that they had bought during World War II. You know, with negatives this big and all that. And sometimes we'd have a Rolleiflex or a Mamiya Flex, which was, you know, the negatives are this big.